Hello, this is Pat Lynch, and you are joining us once again for the Career Pathways Podcast. We come to you every week with podcasts with Lion faculty, Lion staff, people in the community. Today, we have an extra special podcast we're calling Election 2024. Music, Jason?
Da-da-da-da.
There you go. We'll work on that. All right. So with join us today is Dr. Jiayun Song.
Yes.
Okay. So, Jiayun Song, Associate Professor of Political Science, and Dr. Brendan Connell, a two-timer here on the show, Assistant Professor of Political Science.
It's great to be back.
Our second two-timer.
A second two-timer. And also joining us are
Producer Jason.
And in the back, making the magic happen on the magic board. You know, we'll just like in CNN.
You have to yell.
Producer Cheyenne. Oh, there you are. Yes, but
we have to steal her mic.
She went unmiked. She's going unmiked, but not unnoticed. All right. So thank you both. You know, so, you know, one thing we do start the show is we always just, you know, ask our guests to kind of tell us a little about themselves. Brendan, I know you've been here before, but it's still good to, you know, hear, you know, kind of a little bit about you. But we'll start with Jiayun. If you could kind of tell us, like, kind of like,
it's going to be a long story.
Fire
because
away.
I'm from the outside of the United States.
Oh, I really? I thought that
you
was
didn't
a,
know that?
No, I thought it was a Central Arkansas accent, but I'm off. Okay.
All right. So I'm Jiayun. I'm originally from Korea. Not the North Korea. I heard that there's just some students believe that I'm from the North Korea. I don't know why, but I'm from South Korea.
Yes.
Yeah, I grew up in Seoul, and I went to the university, Myeongju University in Seoul, and I majored in political science because I love political science. There's a lot of the dynamics going on, power game. That's much better than studying law, right? So I decided to major in political science. And there's some tipping point that I choose this career path. When I was a junior year, during the summertime, there was a summer course, which is a campaign politics. And the textbook the professor used, that's all about the American elections. So kind of fascinating how they make the strategy and then to win the election. I really liked that one. And then the one of the group project that he gave us is to come up with the campaign strategy for the congresswoman. And then he was pretty ambitious. So he packed all female students in one group. There was a 5 to 6 students. And he actually assigned a female congresswoman, Park Geun-hye. She is the former president, Park Jong-hee's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So we are so interesting to come up with the strategy for the first female president of the South Korea. And so we had a lot of discussions and have a lot of information. And I decided to put all conversation on online.
Mm-hmm.
That was early 2000. And then after a few days later, my professor said that he got the call from the National Assembly. So we thought, oh, we are in the trouble, right? Mm-hmm. But we noticed that one of the staff members from the Congresswoman Park actually contacted him because they wanted to see us.
All right.
So we were invited to the National Assembly, and then we had a really good talk, and then they even buy lunch. That was good, right? Also, we got the information about the Congresswoman Park. It was a really good experience. Also, we met Congresswoman Park. And the funny thing is, later, one of our group members became the first youngest female elected official in local government. And then later, in 2013, the Congresswoman Park became a first female president of the South Korea. Ta-da! And then I got the internship in the National Assembly. I think that was my senior year. And then I decided to come to the United States to study more about the campaign. At the time, there was only 3 schools offered the political management program that actually digging the campaign election strategies. George Washington in Washington, D.C., and University of Florida, and the New York University. These are the only three schools. So I decided, let's go to Capital, right? So I applied for the George Washington, and luckily I got the admission. So I came to the United States. And during my master's, the graduate season, I got some internship at the Korean Assembly, at Korean Embassy, sorry. And then also I got the internship at the Heritage Foundation. And we talk about the Project 2025 coming from the Heritage Foundation, right? It's pretty extremely.
So how much of it did you write?
No, I didn't do that.
That was me.
So a lot of information or a lot of the experience in Washington, D.C., and then I decided to study more. So once I got the master's, then I have to get the PhD. So I came down to the University of Georgia, and one of my professors said, Jaehyun, you have the totally different political cultures, and then you have a totally different experience. And then that was.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at the time. But I didn't know that there's so many trucks in Georgia. And I didn't know that the cows and horses, they are so close to university. But anyway, that was kind of one of the culture shock. And so I got my PhD, and I decided to come to the Lyon. And I think that was 2014. And after 1 year, my husband also got a job in the UCA. So that's why we stuck here for 10 years.
Yeah,
long story, kind of short.
Oh, no, wonderful. And you, Brandon?
All right. So, I mean, I'm political scientist here at Lyon College as well. I've been here for a little bit less time. So I got here in 2022. So it's been about 2.5 years now. I got my PhD at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And then I got my bachelor's degree in political science at Binghamton University, which is a state school in upstate New York. So last time I was here, I don't think I went into like why I got into political science. So maybe I'll talk about that a little bit. I mean, I grew up on Long Island in New York. It's not in Long Island, by the way. It's on Long Island is how you say it. And, so I grew up, actually a lot of my family is like police officers and firefighters. So 9/11 was like the big event. I was in fifth grade. So growing up, I remember that really like hit home. And I think that's probably what even just subconsciously got me into studying political science and namely world politics, international relations. So that's kind of where my specialty is at, is studying international relations and politics at the global level rather than just American politics or domestic politics. So that's kind of what started for me. But, this might seem strange. I tell students this all the time, but I'm actually not like a super politically active person. I mean, I'm definitely probably more so than your average American voter, but there's tons of other stuff I'd rather be doing than just reading politics all the time, right? But really what attracted me to political science was I was always fascinated with just the puzzles that you'll find and just how difficult it is to really isolate causal relationships. So political science is a science, but it's a part of the social sciences. So it's different than the natural sciences, biology, chemistry. And I think most people tend to think of the natural sciences as being slightly more difficult and complex, So they say it's rocket science is, the phrase it's not rocket science, implying that it's very hard. But I think in some ways the social sciences, including political science, is more difficult because we oftentimes can't like put voters in a lab and sort of just run experiments on them, right? For ethical and practical reasons.
Sadly.
In the same way that you could do maybe if you're studying, tomato cells or something, right? So it's sometimes a lot harder to just establish like, does X cause Y when you're in the real world? And that's, I think, frustrating for some people, but I've always just been like intrigued by that. So that's actually what got me into political science, was I was just always fascinated with these questions that have no obvious answers to them. So, and then the rest is history. I got my PhD, and then my first job was here at Lyon College a couple years ago. So, and I love being here. So,
well, thanks. And we have to just give you a nod for the your recently completed Ironman.
Oh, so, yes, the Ultra, yeah. Yes.
Ultra. Yes. Oh, I'm the Ultra. And so in
Ironman means you've got to both swim and bike, and I can barely swim, and I'm not good at cycling. So,
so this was just pure running.
This was pure running, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And how long a distance was it?
This one was 100 miles.
So a nice warm-up.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, just good, yeah.
Now you know why he doesn't have time to look at political science. He's running 100 miles.
Yeah, yeah.
But an amazing feat. And you were you won the entire race, yes?
Yes, I won. So.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's just such an insane achievement. I mean, mm-hmm. how many people could even do that?
Mm-hmm.
You're one of few. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get going.
All right.
Election 2024. Get the better music.
Dun, 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 dun. I'm trying to do that. What? Okay, I got to ask on that. Is there actually like a president's theme? Because I hear that. I hear that like that melody all the time when like talking about political stuff.
It's called "Hail to the Chief."
Yeah,
mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm.
So there is so there is a theme song for the president.
Yes,
unofficially, right?
Okay,
yeah. But yeah.
All right. Assessment. We have two candidates: Kamala Harris, Donald Trump. They each have kind of a platform. Not getting into like who's right, who's wrong, but just what's your assessment as far as the key points of their platform? A lot of times you candidates, don't they try to distill it down that I am for these three things? And then you find out, okay, my opponent is for these three things. And then you try to, parry back and forth. So what's your assessment of, you could take, you can go and assess both, or you guys could take one or the other, whatever you choose.
What do you think? I can take one, you could take the other.
All right, got it. The party platform, that is the list of the policy mm-hmm. The party wanted to pursue. So there's a lot of key issues, a principle, and goals. In 2024, the Democratic Party, Republican Party, they both approved the party platform at the convention during the summertime. And before we talked about the party platform, I just wanted to throw out this pretty interesting theory, which is the issue ownership theory. That means that was introduced around 1996. It says each party actually owns some issues. So by emphasizing those issues, the party will get some benefit. So for example, Democratic Party, they owns issue on education, healthcare, or the social welfare program.
Mm-hmm.
The other side, the Republican Party actually owns voting policy or the security that include the immigrations.
Right.
So if they emphasize these own issues, mm-hmm. then they will get some benefit. So if you look at the party platform, you will see these issues actually emphasized by the both party differently.
Right.
And if I have to pick the issue, which is key issue in this election, I would say abortion. This is a really key issue. And the both candidates do have a pretty different view on that.
Right.
For example, Kamala Harris says she is supporting the federal rights to abortion. And if you remember in March, I think she visited Minnesota, especially abortion clinic.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first time the vice president visit officially the abortion clinic. So that actually indicates her stance on the abortion. The other side, Donald Trump, the former President Trump, actually kind of avoided to say I'm an anti-abortion.
Right.
So rather he said I support the Supreme Court decision that overturned the Roe v. Wade. And he said that this is should be the state decision, not the federal decision. So he kind of
not mine.
Yeah, right.
The states own it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I look at the 2024 the Republican Party platform, and surprisingly, the Republican Party platform mentioned the abortion only once.
Right.
But if you compare to 2016, they actually mentioned about 35 times. So tone has been a little bit changed on the abortion issue. Because of 2022 midterm elections.
Right.
So after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, and the women's tried to rally behind the pro-choice candidates, tended to be Democrats. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the voter turnout, especially female voter turnout in 2022, it's about 68%.
Right.
That's the highest point, highest voter turnout in the congressional elections. And majority of them vote for Democratic Party. Not surprising. I think the Republican Party learned some lesson from there. So that's why they tried to minimize it directly talking about the election. Rather, they emphasize the state.
Mm-hmm. Brandon.
Yeah, I'll add, I mean, I think there's a lot of things that are just similar going back to 2016 and 2020. I would say the Republican position has generally been, specifically the Trump position, has generally been kind of more like the anti-globalist stance.
Yes.
Whether it's more critical of NATO, critical of just international organizations in general, critical of international trade. So a lot of that is kind of old news at this point. That's kind of been the Trump stance the past 8 years or so. And it is kind of funny, though, because you look back before 2016 and Republicans were actually more the pro-globalist, pro-trade right. party. So it's kind of flipped, and I think it's flipped because of Trump in part. But there are some new things. So, like, you know, certainly abortion and the Roe v. Wade reversal with the Dobbs decision is one thing. Immigration's always been... Yeah. An important issue, but I think especially so just with the rate of border crossings. If you go back a year or so ago, interestingly, they've come down to their lowest levels in quite a bit as of late. But it's still, you know, it's an important topic for voters. The economy, which again is always going to be important for any presidential election, but what's probably unique about this one is we're not talking about unemployment or a pandemic anymore. It's about inflation. And then the last thing I would say, too, is just these wars going on right now in Ukraine and Gaza. And, you know, those are tricky, though, because I don't know. I don't think either candidate has really sold me on whether there's a clear path forward or even a ceasefire. But those are issues where, you know, if we talk about October surprises, I mean, just depending on what happens in Gaza or Ukraine the next couple weeks. It is one of those things that could either be an asset or a liability for either candidate, just depending on what happens. So those are some new things that are obviously different back in, you know, the 2020 and 2016 elections. But I don't know. I think more like there's just a lot of similarities just because we've got Trump again. People generally know where Trump stands for better or for worse. People are, I guess, are still learning a little bit about Harris, but yeah, I think a lot of these issues, though, we're talking about in this election are the same issues we've been talking about the past 4 or 5 years.
But, so. You know, one thing, Brandon, that is that in listening to your answers that based on my readings, that one of the top issues for Democrats is democracy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they've defined that a potential Trump administration is going to take America in a place that they worry, and it's all obviously based from you know, January 6th was, well, it happened during the whole Trump administration, but January 6th kind of put an accelerant on it, and that seems to be very important for, you know, for one, you know, one side. I think it is Republicans in a different way, but is that kind of the way both of you see it, that, you know, that is a real drive? Reproductive rights for Democrats, yes, but this thing with democracy seems that is a big driver for people, and it's kind of like anyone but Donald Trump is kind of the way I guess you would articulate it.
Yeah, so the Capitol riots in 2020, so this is the first general election we're having since then, so I've noticed this has been a part of the Democrats' position is this is not just a vote for Harris, this is a vote for democracy.
Yes.
And I think the question then becomes, how much does that resonate amongst voters? And to what extent are voters saying, yes, no, we have to support and maintain our democracy, so we're going to vote for the Harris side. All right, this is my take. I'm a little pessimistic, but I think the support for democracy is generally overstated in public opinion research because the way I've seen this done is you ask a question that says, do you like democracy or do you believe democracy is the best form of government? And that's like asking someone if they like puppies. You know, like no one's going to say they don't like puppies. To the extent that they don't like puppies, they're going to lie about it and say it anyway. So it's kind of like an answer that doesn't really say much. So I think that's one thing. The second thing, unfortunately, this is more problematic because this is not a methodological issue, is I think there's too many voters that are willing to kind of like make a deal with the devil, and they will be totally okay with if you start getting rid of some checks and balances or getting rid of some political rights or undermining the democratic process in some way. They're okay with that as long as it serves or it looks like it serves their interest in the short term.
Yeah.
And that's like the problem is I think when you get Harris or Biden saying we need to vote for democracy, that works for their supporters, I guess. And you hope maybe for some moderates, but in general, I don't know. It doesn't look like that is being that effective in changing attitudes. Yeah. I think what voters care most about is abortion rights, reproductive rights, immigration, the real kind of more substantive stuff. Again, that's just my take, though. So
I totally agree. The Democratic Party wanted to emphasize democracy. If you look at the party platform, that is the one of the top key issues they wanted to push out. But how they deliver the message, that's kind of not clear. So that's why the people confuse what the Democratic Party really wanted to perceive to have a good democracy. Right. Also, if you think about the nature of the campaign, especially very polarized the arena, for example, the 2024 is going to be really close comparativeness. According to the study, if it is a highly polarized, then that actually enhances issue voting. So enhanced issue voting or the higher polarization means you will see a lot of difference between the Democratic Party, Republican Party candidates that actually motivate voters to come out because there is a pretty clear hint who to vote for. So that's why the abortion, immigration, economy, that's are the highly salient issue in this comparative election. But it's pretty hard to differentiate the person in democracy, so that's why it's kind of wash away.
Going back to the, I was going to mention, but going back to like the war aspect of it, which is the, you know, we have two wars going on with the Palestinian war being a little more prevalent in today's news, with not either side kind of taking a real stance. Is that solely because they're too, not necessarily afraid, but worried that they're going to lose support? Or is there some more like behind the scenes things that kind of play into those factors, like of to not like really like say like, here's why we have a clear plan and we're going to, you know, do these things. They're not saying anything like that because they're worried that they're going to lose support because it may show that they're favoring one side over the other in a way. Is that kind of, are we seeing that more so, or is there another factor?
Yeah, I think it's just a prickly issue that no one really wants to touch at the moment. It's kind of a lose-lose issue because of, I think because of just domestic politics. So like there's a very powerful Israeli lobby in Washington. There's always been. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, there's the opposite, that there are a lot of voters as well as special interests that are a little bit more on the Palestinian side. I think I even read yesterday, like Michigan is just
Dearborn, Michigan.
So Michigan's a coin flip right now. Yeah. And I know Michigan, like they've got like in terms of, migrant populations or just in terms of ethnicity, like a lot of Arab Americans that are, you know, not anti-Israel per se, but certainly they want this solution to the conflict, or they want, you know, they probably want the U.S. to try to take more stricter steps to try to prevent what we've seen is like civilian casualties and bombing that is not just hitting Hamas, but bombing that's hitting everyday civilians. Yeah. So so again, it's like no matter what side you take, you're kind of alienating someone that matters in the electorate.
Yeah.
So I mean, this is like, I don't think we'll have a solution until after the election, and then we'll kind of see where the candidates really stand. But I haven't seen, like, you know, you even watched the presidential debates. I mean, there's not, I didn't hear any clear answers in terms of how we get out of Gaza or right. not get out of Gaza, but what you do in Gaza or what we do with regarding Ukraine, because mm-hmm. they're just such prickly issues.
Yeah, I totally agree. So one of the voting theory is a retrospective voting. That means the voters actually evaluate the current administration. Based on the evaluation, they actually decided who to vote for. Either they wanted to vote for the in-party candidates, or incumbent candidates, or the out-party candidates. This election is pretty weird because when we talk about the incumbent administrations, is it Democratic Party or the Republican Party? Because Donald Trump was a former president. Mm-hmm. So he ran the government. At the time, there was the issue going on. So how we can attack it, the administration's policy, especially mm-hmm. on the voting policy. That's kind of the weird to make the evaluation where they have some clear stance on that. So that's why they kind of avoid, do not attack that one, because there's always a weakness point. Right. They can fighting each other.
And there's no, so with this is also kind of weird too, because there technically isn't really an incumbency advantage, really, is there? Because I mean, technically Kamala Harris is the vice president and they're, you know, and Joe Biden's the current president, but is there still an incumbency advantage, even though she is not like the sitting president? Do they still kind of get that same type of, like, do they get looked at the same way as like, well, it's the vice president and the president, so they're the ones in control right now? Or is it kind of like looking at a whole different person? Like if it would be like a 2016 election, let's say.
Not a totally different person, but when I went to the conference, they talk about the unique of the 2024 election. For example, incumbent president decided to drop out. Mm-hmm. That happened only one time. That was 1968 with Lyndon Johnson. Right. So, and then vice president, she didn't run any primary, but she was elected at the convention. So, is she really incumbent?
Mm-hmm.
Right. I mean, but if you look at Donald Trump, right? He ran the 4 years, so maybe he's incumbent. So that was a kind of the strange nuance in these elections. That's why we talk about this election will be a little bit different than the other election.
You know, when we were touching on the platforms and brought up all the big issues, you know, reproductive rights, immigration, touches on the topic of single issue voters. You know, and you know, Brandon, you and I have had this conversation, and you know, how many single issue vote, like if you look at the percent of the electorate, how many do you see being real, like truly single issue voters, or are people, you know, voting on a variety of issues? I'm kind of can you walk through this, because I hear this all the time, and is that truly how people cast their vote, is on this issue alone important enough to me that I'm going to choose the candidate based on that? And what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, I'll throw a number out. I mean, I think it's 90% of voters are just going to look at the issue they most care about, or maybe the two issues they most care about, and they're voting on the basis of that. So like, it's good you mentioned the alternative is, like, I guess you can sort of compile like a pros and cons list, and you could, you know, talk about all the policies you care about, what your preferences are, and then go research the candidates. And yeah, it's probably what a good Democratic citizen would do. You know, they'd get fancy with it. They, you know, but in truth, that's just not the way that most voters behave. I mean, first off, like most voters, I would say they've got more pertinent things to do. They're working two different full-time jobs. They're taking care of families. Like, they don't have this time to sit down and do that sort of thing. Right. And even if they did, most people, like, we forget about this because we're on, you know, a college campus. Right. So it's a different type of demographic than what you'll find in the general mm-hmm. electorate. But most people just aren't super engaged with politics. They're actually pretty apolitical at times, or they're just not paying attention. They'd rather be watching sports. They'd rather be watching, I don't know, MTV. I don't know what the kids watch these days. But they got other stuff that they do. Okay, they go out and vote, but then it's like, what are they voting on the basis of? Heuristics, I would say, just rules of thumb. They're just picking the issues that they really care about. Those issues tend to be things like the economy and reproductive rights and immigration, maybe foreign policy and issues regarding wars going on abroad. But they're only picking a couple of those. They generally just know where the candidate roughly stands, and they'll cast a vote off of that. Because that literally takes 30 seconds out of your day to do. It doesn't take much thinking. And humans are, including myself, I may run 100 milers, but humans are generally lazy. They will take the path of least resistance. Right. I don't mean that in a negative thing. It's a rational thing. Like, why would you do more than what's needed to do, right? To vote, you use simple heuristics rather than sort of going through this long list of things. So in general, that's, I think, the way that most voters work.
I totally agree. But issue voting can be seen as the pretty special in the comparative elections. As I mentioned earlier, highly polarized the campaign or the elections actually generates more the issue voting. But if you think about the issue voting, that means that people actually, or the voters, consider some of the issues to make decisions. But there are the two different types of the voting, issue voting. The first one is a proxy voting. That means these voters actually use the information and compared their preference with the other candidates, right? And then if the candidates are really close to their preferences, and then they will vote for the candidates. And the single issue voters, they rely on the few issues to make the decisions. Mm-hmm. But here's our assumptions. To have the issue voting, it is a requires the voters do have, as you mentioned, the cognitive engagement or the political sophistication. Mm-hmm. So if you think about the American voters, the study shows that, yes, they know something about the politics. However, they are poorly informed. So do they really have the ability to compare its different issues by the party or by candidates? That's pretty skeptical. That's a totally different topic. And I found one of the pretty interesting poll by the Pew Research. They ask about how many issues do you really care to make a decision? And then the poll said that about 5% said that, yeah, I care zero issues and one issue. And 25% said that, yeah, two to four issues they care to make a decision. And 44% said 5 to 6. But again, if you think about the comparativeness, it's really close. If you look at the poll today, the Harris and the Trump, the margin of the popular vote is about the 2.5%. Right. It's going to be really close. So that those kind of issues will be enhanced the people to make decisions who do vote.
And do you disagree that like single issue voting probably is more or better defined right now between these two candidates than it has been in many past elections? What was the defining single issue between Barack Obama and Mitt Romney? There was like you started, it was so much similarity, really. But now you look at reproductive rights, immigration. I mean, just those two I could see as being driving, driving forward democracy or the economy, inflate or just call it inflation. I mean, I could see the single issue voting being much more prominent in this election than maybe past elections. What are your thoughts?
Maybe. I think it'd be more accurate to say that things are just more partisan.
Okay.
We mentioned polarization already. So the platforms, at least in some respects and on paper, have maybe grown further apart.
Right.
So what might look like people only care about a certain amount of issues, I think it might be more accurate to say that there's just a lot of people that are voting right no matter what. There's a lot of people voting left no matter what. So that's what I would say. I wonder if it's almost recency bias. I'm trying to think about the Obama-Romney election. I guess that was healthcare might have been the major thing, or was that?
Yeah, it was Romney. They were going to dismantle healthcare.
Yeah. So I don't know. I wonder if we got in a time machine and went back, would things seem equally neatly divided? But maybe
there, there were also like a lot of rights about like gay and like LGBTQ rights during that election. And like, and like
Biden let kind of let it out of the bottle.
So that was,
but definitely polarization. And I mean, this stuff you can measure and clearly. I remember when I was in college and like 2010 around there, we were talking then about we were living in the most polarized America we've ever lived in, and now it's gotten worse. So it's really been going in that direction. I would say since the 90s. You could just look at even how Congress votes, and there's just like this bimodal distribution of the left going more left and the right going more right. So,
And there's a pretty interesting polls also that out there. They said, let's look at the three key issues 2024, abortion, immigration, economy, and looking at the how the partisans support the candidates differently. Abortion is a pretty interesting. The among who think the abortion is really important, only 68% support Kamala Harris. That actually went down if you compare with the 2022. So abortion is still pretty highly salient issue, but degree it has been changed. But if you look at the immigration, if the people think the immigration is really important, and then 36% roughly support Kamala Harris. However, 83% of them actually supported Trump. So immigration, so that issue, actually partisan issue, right? So if you think that issue really important, then they more leaning toward the Republican side. Economy is kind of same thing. So by looking at that poll, I will say the Kamala Harris is kind of having problems to mobilize and they energize her base based on the issue.
You mentioned polls a lot of time. Let's talk polling, because that seems to be just such an interesting thing in that how, you know, the polls in 2016, 2020 were wrong. You know, they underestimated the level of Trump support. And and so then here you are 2024, how do pollsters, you know, grapple with that, you know, and, you know, it's just one of these that, you know, is there a way to correctly sample? Is there, you know, there's, because, you know, that's how they make their business. And we're inundated with, oh, you know, Harris is up 47 to 48 in Pennsylvania. Oh, wait, Harris is down 46 to 48 in Michigan, you know, and is any of it true? Because the amount of, not even right there, it's just statistically, you know, a dead heat. But then you start wondering if the underlying numbers are, how accurate they are. If we've had 8 years of consistent polling kind of shortfalls. And what are your thoughts on this? How do political pollsters kind of operate now in 2024?
Wants to go for okay. Yeah, I have a lot of different things to say probably here.
He has some things to say.
Because there's a lot of just misperceptions about like polling and what it is and what its limits are. It's never going to be 100% accurate because it's polling. I mean, that's the first thing to mention. There's always going to be a margin of error. And so we forget that sometimes because the way you'll see polls reported on, you know, pick whatever news network, they're tracking it almost like odds to a sports game or something. Right. And they're doing it on purpose because they want to bring in viewers. They actually want to present it like a horse race. That's what they want to do. But yeah, like I said, I mean, there's so much limit to polls because of margin of error and just measurement error. So I guess one thing I'll say first off is, like how do you actually do polling? There's, you know, a population that we're interested in studying. So this is the people that turn out to vote in 2024. Mm-hmm. We can't observe that yet until we get time machines. So we're stuck to trying to measure samples, which are much smaller little buckets that we're taking and we're hopefully randomly sampling out of the American population. But think about that for a second. Is in order for polling to work perfectly, you have to randomly sample. And randomly sampling is hard because we live in a democracy and I can't force someone to fill out a poll if they don't want to. So it's all voluntary and you've got people that need to opt into your sample. And that's where you run into problems is, does my sample look like what the voting population is going to look like in 2024? It's never going to look perfectly right. Like that. So then you get into, how do I fix my sample and make it look more like the population I'm trying to measure? And that's where you get into weighting techniques. And it gets fancy. There's simple weighting techniques. There's more teched up ways of doing it. But generally, you're trying to make adjustments, count certain people in your sample more than others to try to recorrect the estimates for who's going to support Harris, who's going to support Trump. But any effort you make is likely doomed to be a little bit imperfect. And there's some research or so that even the different weighting strategies, they could do more harm mm-hmm. than good. So we're all kind of guessing, the polling firms. Right. Like, I hear some close friends and family members at times, they think the polling is like corrupt in a way, like it's deliberately skewed. That's not what's going on. Polling's imperfect, but what's happening is it's just impossible to get a random sample, and you've got to try to fix after the fact to address that problem. So that's one of many things I could say about polling. So it's my take on polling. It's actually very good at getting a good prediction, but right. predictions are never perfect. There's always a margin of error. And then sometimes you could run into where we're actually systematically understating or overstating support for a candidate, but that has nothing to do with like polls being rigged in some way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why we said a 95% confidence. We never say the 99% or the 100%. That's impossible as right. a mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But also I wanted to mention about the environment of the election. So for example, in 2000, if you remember, the Florida was really close, right. and then mainstream media said that Al Gore will be the winner by carrying the Florida because they make that predictions based on the exit poll.
Right.
And a few hours later, the Florida Secretary of the State figured out the actual winning in the Florida is George W. Bush.
Right.
And then the mainstream media, just to withdraw the projections, and then they said it is too close to call. So we are seeing the more competitive elections, really close elections. If it is really close, it's pretty hard to predict,
right?
Mm-hmm. 2000, it was a nightmare for the booster, but think about the nature. At the time, the popular winner was Al Gore, mm-hmm. not the George W. Bush, right? He won the electoral vote, not the popular vote.
Right.
But at the time, the polls more likely talking of the popular vote, not the electoral vote, right? And if you think of the Florida itself, the Al Gore won by only 537 votes over the George W. Bush. So it was pretty hard to predict, only 537 votes. That's within the error margin.
Mm-hmm.
So same thing in the 2024, it's really close, right? The gap between the Harris and the Trump as of today is just 2.5%. It's really, really close. So even though we had a good sampling method, we use a lot of different weight variable, but because of this nature, it's pretty hard to predict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, another thing too, I think is interesting with polling is even like you can't poll every single person that's going to vote. And so like we talked about that in American Experience where like then you get a lot of places where it would be like, you know, if let's say a very Republican style newspaper or magazine runs a poll, it's more than likely that the people who are going to opt in for that poll would be people who probably vote Republican and so on and so on. So that's kind of it, with when it comes to like predicting the Electoral College, is there like a better method than just like saying like, well, the popular vote shows this, so we're just going to base it off this? Or when it's this close, is it kind of a little too difficult to call? Like mm-hmm. you said, when it's like 2.5%, is it is there really any, you know, is it just eye candy in a way, basically then?
Sometimes. I mean, it's like I said, it's a best guess. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you mentioned it's impossible to poll all 300 million plus Americans. Mm-hmm. And the problem's worse than that, because if you think about it, the population you're trying to measure is not all Americans. It's not all adult Americans. It's not all voting age Americans. You are trying to measure the people that vote.
Mm-hmm. Likely.
We don't know that.
Yeah.
So you could do your polling, but you might be polling people that aren't going to turn out to vote on election day. I think that's where most of the uncertainty is it's actually not with undecided voters or anything like that, but it's more just what's the turnout going to look like on both sides. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, where you get into trouble with trying to, like, you're trying to correct your estimates after the fact, after you sample, because you're trying to figure out, does my bucket of observations look like what the bucket's going to look like on election day in November? We don't know what that bucket looks like until it happens. Mm-hmm. So you're stuck guessing. And then that's, again, where we've got, you know, margin of error and these imperfections in the polling. So. I don't even know if I answered your question. I'm sorry.
One of the underlying problem with the polling. I think that was just starting maybe 2003. They talking about the using the cell phone. So traditional polls, they actually dial, right? Yeah. And then ask a question and they get the information. Even though you have a really good technique to get the samples, represent the population, but it's pretty hard to get them to get the answer the questions. For example, as of today, I think so 75% of Americans do have only cell phone, no landline. So, for example, kind of same thing, I do have only cell phone. And if you see the unknown numbers on your cell phone, will you answer?
No, right?
Yeah. So that's why we have a weight issue, but it's really hard to reach these people, even though we sampled randomly that represent the population. Also, there is some legal aspect. So, for example, some states do have some regulations. If you wanted to call the cell phone, you have to get this consent, right? That's kind of using and marketing, right? So those are kind of things that make the polls really hard, even though we have a good sample. It's really hard to get the answer from our sample. So nowadays, we are kind of moving to online survey. But online survey is really convenient. It's pretty easy to get the answers. However, still, it has a problem. Sample bias problem, self-selection problem, or also the identity of the respondent. So still, there is a problem, but we're kind of using the many different techniques to get the accurate polls.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, Brendan, you mentioned this just a bit ago, the undecided voter.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I have talked about this, that I cannot wrap my mind around that there is an undecided voter out there. I mean, I remember I sat in on a student, it was one of our honors classes, and all the students were going to do a podcast. And one of the students that we won't, I won't mention, but his name's Josh Archer. But he had this whole thing against the undecided voter and how he wanted to sit down with them and, you know, and kind of school them. And I said, you know, slow down, you know, switch to decaf, you know, just, you know, and just, but, you know, I just cannot, in something that just seems like you got a very clear choice of two real, you know, kind of really well-defined positions to me, two choices, or even an independent. I can't even tell you who's out there, but how can there be under, like, any meaningful level of undecided voters? Help a novice, you know, help, make sense of this world.
Well, first, I mean, a majority of voters are not undecided, a large majority. I mean, for those that are partisan and a Republican, they're going Trump. For those that are solidly Democrat, they're going to go Harris. And then even amongst independents, most of these independents are really Republicans or Democrats that just don't want to say they're part of party, but they're voting one way or the other. But so there is a small sliver of people, though, that are undecided voters. I probably share your frustration or Josh's frustration, I guess, with, you know, like, how could you not know? But I mean, it goes back to, I think what I was saying before, which is we forget that most people are just kind of tuned out from politics. So, I would almost call these undecided voters fickle voters instead of undecided. Like, I think if you ask people, they'll have an answer, but they might change their answer depending on what side of the bed they woke up. Because they're just
Are they likely to vote?
Probably less likely than kind of the solid partisan people that are going to be more committed. But the interesting thing about this election is it doesn't take much. It's so close where it might literally come down to those undecided voters, whatever you want to call them, specifically in the battleground states. Right. So, especially this late in an election season, I mean, most people are decided. I understand it more like, you know, when Biden stepped down and Harris stepped up, people still probably needed to learn about Harris. We've already known about Trump because we had him as president and there was a presidential debate and people know Trump. There was a learning process with Harris, but I think that learning process now is more or less kind of over. So at this point in time, I think most people probably know which way they're going. But there's always, I tell my students all the time, most people in your survey are just weirdos. They, I say that lovingly, you know, but they're just, you know, they're not super committed. They're not paying attention. Yeah. So they're just a little fickle.
Right.
Yeah.
So as you pointed out, if it is really close election, undecided voters can be really important, right? So if you think about the funnel of causality, the theory, it says there is a funnel, and then we kind of build up our party identification, which is a long-term effect. So parents are involved in, and then your school or the social status. Those kind of things all together create your party ID. This is a long-term effect. Once you form your party ID, it's rarely changed. So, for example, 2020, 94% of Democrats voted for Joe Biden. Not surprised, right? And then 94% of Republicans voted for the Trump. This funny of causality also narrowed down by having more the short-term effect in the vote choice. So such as a campaign issue, the candidate evaluation, those kind of short-term factors influence the final vote choice. But it shows that it's all about the partisan. If you are Democrats, we're almost 90%, we know how you voted.
Right.
So the whole partisan, that's kind of question. So if you look at the poll 2024, I noticed that the Democrats are about 31% and the Republicans are about 27%. And surprisingly, 44% they identify themselves as independent. However, independents, they are the leaners. There are just some leaners leaning toward the Democratic Party a little bit more, the Republican Party a little more. So if you take it out, the leaners to the partisan, I would say Democratic Party, there's a 49% of them Democrats, including leaners. And the Republican side is about the 45%.
Right.
So if we have some simple calculation, so we know from the previous election, 94% of the Democrats, Republicans, they were going to vote for their party. So if you take it out, 94% of the 45% Republican, 94% of the 49% of Democrats, actually about 5%, they are undecided. In other words, they can vote for the other party or the third party candidate. Right. 5% in this close election is really critical. Right? That's why if you think of the Kamala Harris, that she is talking about the third party effect, which is a spoiler, especially Green Party candidates. They actually take the vote from the Democratic Party, if it is really close, Michigan, Pennsylvania, those are kind of the vote is really critical. But think about the 2000, Al Gore lost Florida by 537. And at the time, there's a third party candidate. Yes.
Yeah.
He got the 97,000.
Right, right. And then RFK Jr. was floating out there, and they were worried he'd take Republican votes. Now he aligned himself with Trump. Yeah. So now, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of, you know, the play is that maybe the Kennedy name will take that undecided. Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting.
I wanted to go one last kind of thing, and that's vice presidents. And so we see, like, you know, we see, like, they have debates.
You had to get some Minnesota in here somewhere.
I actually was about to say, with my governor being in here, I think it's kind of interesting to talk about, like, the vice president's role in an election. And so we see, like, you know, like, they just had a debate, J.D. Vance and Tim Walz. But does that actually sway voters at all, like the vice president? Or is it kind of more of just a formality? Like, they do people really actually, like, care that much about who the vice president is to the candidate that is running?
It won't change much, but again, it's a close enough election where it only has to change things a little bit. I would say the benefit of, like, a VP candidate or VP pick is you can kind of, like, take their home state. Mm-hmm. So, like, Minnesota, the last time I checked, it's a swing state, but it seems like it's going to go Harris. This is why I think there were, you know, some people I've talked to, they maybe thought she should have went with the Pennsylvania governor.
Shapiro.
Yeah.
Shapiro, because that would help her win Pennsylvania, which is a very critical state for the Democrats. So in that sense, it could help a bit. And that's at least one strategy for how you pick a vice president. You know, another way to go about it is to try to choose someone that kind of balances you out. So the Walz pick, I guess, made sense from where I'm standing, because not only are you picking someone from Minnesota, but was it the first clip I saw of Walz after he got picked was he's decked out in camo talking about hunting. That balances against at least the image that was being painted of Harris of, what's the Trump side still saying? Like,
San Francisco comrade elite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So more of kind of, we want to show that, you know, this is a party that is still kind of speaking for the people.
Mm-hmm.
So it matters in that sense, but, it's again, probably overstated. Like, I think what voters care most about are the policy issues, like real substantive stuff. Rather than who you're going to run as vice president. I mean, vice president is kind of a powerless position. It's gotten more powerful over time, I guess, because just the nature of how the positions evolved. I think vice presidents, they can maybe use the spotlight a little bit better than they did a couple decades ago. But if you think about it, like, besides being second up, the vice president doesn't really have any constitutional authority to do much. Yeah. So
I'm glad you asked the question, because I just have the class, my campaign class, talking of how we pick the vice presidential candidates and then what is the effect of these selections. And I asked the students, do you really care who are the vice president of the fans or the awards? Do you really care? And they said, I don't mind. So I would say the effects of the picking, choosing the vice president is pretty minimal.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some cases that vice president picking is really important. For example, I would say 1992, right? The Bill Clinton choose the Al Gore because he wanted to enhance the southern borders. That became more the Republican. So he wanted to bring these borders for the Democratic Party. That has a pretty significant impact. Also the 2000, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, right? As he mentions, a balance ticket, like a Washington insider and an outsider, that was pretty successful. J.D. Vance, I think that's also another balance ticket because of the age.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the political scientists, I met some of them at the conventions, and then they said that was the worst choice.
Yeah.
But he didn't provide any evidence, but he said that the J.D. Vance, that's not a good choice for the Trump.
He didn't build his base where if he could have convinced Nikki Haley, then you would have kind of brought
the party together.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, weren't there also like some past clips where J.D. Vance wasn't really agreeing with Trump either? So then it kind of looked like he not necessarily was bandwagoning, but was just kind of like, oh, yeah, I'll be the vice president because I get to be the vice president if I win.
Yeah, yeah.
So
calling your future boss a Hitler usually doesn't go well.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least what I've seen. But then, you know, for VP picks, you know, they tend to not get a lot of notice until Sarah Palin.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there that's one where I think that for McCain, that kind of brought question. I mean, she was novel in the beginning, and then all of a sudden, you know, when she started talking and people got to know her, they started, I think, questioning McCain's judgment.
It's crazy how times change, because I remember, I was pretty young when that was happening, but she debated Biden, and I remember the whole narrative going in was, like, there was concern that Biden was going to come off as this super arrogant person because he was just so experienced, and she was, you know, this governor from Alaska that had no experience, and there's the gender dynamics too. And it's just funny because, you know, what did we get a couple months ago with Biden in the last debate? Man, things really changed. But
I really enjoyed it, right? 2008, if you remember Saturday Night Live. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
Tina Fey, I mean, she nailed it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
Well, wrapping up, we try to go with two super easy questions. So here you go. Who's going to win the election?
I knew that was coming.
Yeah, you did. Yes, you did. And then the other question is, when will the election be decided? Because November 5th is election day. I don't think it's going to be, they're going to call it that night. But I'll let you guys explain it. So two easy questions.
Yeah.
Fire away.
Who wants to go first?
You almost got out of here. You almost left Scott.
So close.
I know, yeah.
So close.
I hate the question because when I was in South Korea, I was in get on the taxi, and then taxi driver asked me, "What is your major?" I said, "Political science."
Yeah.
At the time, there was a presidential election, and he asked me, "Do you think who's going to be winners?" I don't know. Major in political science is totally different, right? Having the prediction. Usually the October, the political scientists release a forecasting model, and they do have some kind of predictions by using the few variable before, I think it's during the convention or the, I think it's during the labor day, they kind of collect the data and then try to predict the election outcome. What I heard is they actually predict the Paris do have a little bit better chance, but the things change dramatically. Like October surprise, we don't know what's going to be happen this week. And next week, the early voting will start. So there's just so many uncertainty. So I don't know who's going to be winner. It's all about the battleground states. So you have to pay attention. Michigan, Georgia, interestingly, came out again. And Pennsylvania or the Nevada. So depending on these battleground states and the moment will be who's going to be the winner. But when we will know the outcome, maybe December, when the electors cast their ballot.
When did we know for 2020? I actually don't remember. How long did that take?
It wasn't that long. It was like or two.
Well, it could have stretched into like 4 or 5 days because it was, wasn't it Arizona that when it was finally called that kind of, in Arizona, they just had a lot of counting issues. So it took them about that. Georgia was delayed. There were a couple of, others.
Seems like Nevada always gets delayed. I remember that happening in 2020 too. Yeah. That it was like one of the last states.
Yeah, I imagine it'll be similar this time around.
Yeah.
Let me answer the first question. I'll preface this too. I'm going to defend the political science department a bit because there is a misperception in that our expertise, we do not forecast.
Right.
Generally speaking, I mean, sometimes that's what people will do, but political science is not about predicting the future. If it was, I'd probably be a very rich man and I'd be predicting who's going to win the World Series, but. No, like we're more in establishing causal relationships, X cause Y, which is slightly different. Now, that said, I'll give my guess. I mean, two reasons I'm going to guess. I'm going to guess Trump. The first is I think immigration and the economy mm-hmm. are the biggest issues right now, and I think those are both liabilities for the Democrats. Interestingly, economy is actually doing pretty good, and that includes inflation. Inflation's under 3%, but again, it's just the perceptions. People are hurting from inflation that we've seen. And immigration, same sort of thing. That actually has been kind of curtailed quite a bit. But people still view it as a problem, and it's still, I think, a liability for the Democrats. So if I'm just going off of the issues, I think that there's some stuff that is, in my view, is going to be hard to overcome for the Democrats. The second part of my answer and why I'm going to lean Trump is because it's so close. And if I'm basing my prediction off of what the past two elections look like, we know that Trump will outperform the polls at least a little bit. If he does, he's going to win enough battleground states where he'll win. So part of what I'm doing is I'm making a correction in my head to say that I will add a percentage point or two to Trump's polling numbers, and that's all he needs to win states like Michigan and Georgia and North Carolina and all these critical battleground states. So that's my best guess. I'll probably be wrong.
All right. Well, and I can help you on the World Series. It's the Dodgers.
The Dodgers. Okay. I'm going Mets. So, and you know I'll be wrong.
And this is recorded, so now
I know nothing.
We'll know the outcome by the time this comes out.
Okay.
We'll flash it on screen. Connell is wrong.
I have one more thought about the prediction who's going to be winner. We talked about the undecided voters, right? 5%. And I just looked at a recent poll, and then they said the 5% will be undecided.
Right.
Who are they? That's the question, right? And then they said that they are the younger voters and the non-whites. So if the Kamala Harris do have a very heavy campaign to motivate them to go out, 5% is pretty big, right? So there's just a chance because I'm a person who believe a campaign really matters. So we'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, real good. Well, thank you both, Brendan, Jaeyoung. It's been a great conversation. And thank you for listening to the Career Pathways podcast. Now, producer Jason, Cheyenne, they're going to drop this episode on Monday, the 21st, which happens to be early voting, starting in Arkansas. And I can remember back in 2020, On a Monday, I was living in Atlanta, Georgia, and I went for the first day of early voting, proudly, long line, was glad to be there, and I saw yesterday they had record turnout as far as voters. And so I'm hoping this is a record turnout for this country, for Arkansas, for Batesville, and I encourage all of you, please, please vote. Also encourage you to listen to the Career Pathways podcast. That was a shameless transition, wasn't it? But nevertheless, you know, we are marketers. So again, thanks for listening to the Career Pathways podcast. As always, I'm joined by
producer Jason
and
producer Diane.
Yep, way there in the back. And we always close with producer Jason informing our audience about where they can find the Career Pathways podcast.
Well, you can find the Career Pathways podcast on 99.97% of platforms, the same number of germs that get killed with Germex. So that's our little coup de grace.
And we agreed for this podcast there would be no fact checking.
Yeah.
So, all right. So with that, thank you all. And we hope you continue to join us on the Career Pathways podcast. Take care.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Lyon College and by Kilt Studios.